This is Calliope Writing Coach, the podcast about writing and publishing success from every angle. I'm Angie Fenimore, international best-selling author and writing coach.
And I'm Michael Sheen, author, platform designer, and marketing master. Episode 22, Check Your Ego at the Door. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach Podcast. Michael Sheen here with my sweetheart, Angie Fenimore. And we have an exciting guest today. We've got John Bingham with us. Welcome, John.
Welcome yourself. Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
We're just thrilled to have you.
Yeah.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
John Bingham is a highly successful ghostwriter with more than 30 years of writing, editing, business, marketing, sales, and leadership experience. And having worked in executive writing and leadership positions for large successful companies, John has a wealth of knowledge. He and his team have written 117 books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers. Together, they have written books for top business executives, entrepreneurs, speakers, and political candidates, including several senatorial, gubernatorial, and congressional candidates. John helps others tell their stories in their own words, from their perspective, and in the proper context. Awesome. So you've had quite a career in writing.
You know, I have. It's writing's the only thing I ever really wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I found it so difficult to make a living in the early days that I ended up doing a lot of other things. But that became part of my story. I took the long way around the barn, and it really facilitated what I do today. So I'm actually glad that it worked out the way it did.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you begin your career in writing? Where did you start? What?
I was in college. I was a double major, and I thought that, I wanted to write for a living. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking that I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do in life. So I thought I would probably just sample a little sum of everything. Mm-hmm. And write about it and make a living on the articles. That was my first thought of how I might, you know, make writing pay. But really, it was an unwillingness to settle down to any one thing that kind of set me that way. I had always written, even in high school. I was a writer and liked to write. I will admit, though, I graduated back in the early 70s. And so when I was in high school, for a guy to come along and say that he was a writer wasn't considered very macho. It's not like it is today where you can have some sort of an intellectual pursuit and still be manly. And so I was a football player and a swimmer and a diver, and I did all those things, and I kept the writing on the down low quite a bit.
That's funny.
But I would secretly write quite a bit.
Yeah.
So later on, when I got to college and came up with this decision to sample life and write about it and get paid, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but it really didn't work very well. So.
Well, you know, what a lot of new writers struggle with is being able to make ends meet,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I remember writing through the night. I got in the habit of staying up one night a week, all night long, so that I could take care of kids, have the day job, pay the bills, and write.
Right. I did similar things. But I finally came to the conclusion that I was going to have to get a real job, so to speak. That's how all my friends and family describe it. Mm-hmm. I was going to have to get a real job and put the writing on hold. So I continued to write. And I think that's important. We always hear writers write, and they do. Mm-hmm. You always write. It doesn't matter what it's about. It doesn't matter if anybody reads it. It just has to do with honing your craft and becoming confident that you can communicate by the written word as well as you speak or any other type of communication. And so writers write.
Right.
What I ended up doing, I'd had some door-to-door sales jobs while I was in college, and so I had a little bit of business experience. And Steve Covey and I became friends when I was in college. He was, of course, teaching at the school, and I was dating his oldest daughter. It didn't last very long. We didn't really have a lot going on, but sweet as could be. If I saw her today, I would give her a big hug. But in that moment where I had been out with her a few times, and he recognized that, and we got chatting a little bit, and then when I'd see him from time to time, he was very free with his counsel and advice. In fact, one of the first things he said to me, he said, "You know, you're the most unemployable guy I ever met in my life."
Funny. That's so great.
And I said, "Well, okay. What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, he said, look, you're a pretty quick study. You can walk into a situation and see it for what it is. Mm-hmm. That's a talent. He said, but nobody's going to want to hire you and have you walk in the first day with no regard for authority, no regard for title, no regard for the politics of the office place, and start telling them how things should be. With no regard for how they've been or who established how things are. He said, so nobody's going to watch you around, even if you're right, even if you're giving them good counsel. Who are you? Mm. And so no one's going to want to have you around. And I wonder
if he would have given you different advice if you weren't dating his daughter. You know, I'm just curious.
That may have been his concern.
That may have been something to do.
Don't go very far with this, kids, because he can't make a living.
Yeah, really.
But then he said, but those are some qualities that you might find important as a consultant, so let me help you.
Hmm. I've heard this about him, that he takes people under his wing.
Mm-hmm. And he did for me. And he, you know, he made a couple of phone calls to kind of get me my first couple of consulting gigs. And my job was to do exactly what he described. Go in, survey the situation, determine what could be better, and tell them.
Hmm.
And then if they wanted me to hang around long enough to implement the solutions, then that was another contract. And I started a business consulting career that very quickly developed into a contract consulting career within the telecommunications industry.
Mm.
And I spent about 15 years doing that. And that was my job, to go into existing businesses and to establish a phone center, both inbound and outbound, for customer service, sales, whatever it may be, anything from stringing the phone lines and building, you know, the workstations, to hiring and training and writing scripts for customer service use and so on. And so I did that, and I learned a lot, and I learned the language of business, and there were a lot of things that I learned.
And you did this for how long?
15 years.
15 years.
Mm-hmm. All the time writing on the side.
I like swear up and down, it's all transferable skills. Everything else that you do, you know, work serves that, you know, the writer in you as well.
Particularly as a ghostwriter. And I'll swing back to that in a minute, because that became it was a great training period of my life. One of the last clients I picked up as a contract consultant was a medical laser company that specialized in dental lasers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I was going to be able to work my way into an in-house writing gig, maybe working in the marketing department, writing all of their ad copy and all the things that go, because it was a startup company. They'd only done about $5 million the previous year, which in the laser world is not much, to, you know, $5 million of annual revenue.
It pays for one laser. Yeah.
And so long story short, I thought, you know, this is an opportunity to maybe write for a living. And I made the comment to somebody early on, within the first couple of weeks of being there, that you're not doing a very good job of training people. You sell the lasers and then they don't have enough confidence to use them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sitting in the corner of the operatories and not really being used.
Right.
And the word is starting to go out that don't buy that. I'm sorry, I bought mine because I'm not using it. Mm. And that's going to hurt your marketing. About 2 weeks after that, they came to me and said, you know, you're exactly right. So what we need to do is we need to have you involved with the sales department, and you need to teach people how to use these lasers because nobody else has the time.
Oh.
And I said, well, that would be great, but I haven't been to dental school or medical school. And he says, we don't care. Figure it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so long story short, I did. I started going to every single CE course I could that was intended for dentists to teach them how to use lasers. I spent the better part of a year going to every single CE course I could find. And I was so dumb when it came to anything dental that I'm sitting in the back. I remember distinctly sitting in the back row of a conference and taking notes and looking up things that they were saying in my dental glossary that I didn't understand. And I remember the guy from the front of the room said something about gingival tissue. And so I was looking it up under the J's.
Oh, no.
The gingival is with a G. That's really how basic my understanding or lack of understanding was in dentistry. But long story short, I learned quite a bit. And I learned enough that while I'm not a dentist, I never have been, I was able to learn enough about lasers and the laser application in a dental setting that I first taught one technique. And then I taught another and then added to that little by little. And the short version of the story to wrap up this part of it is that I spent the next 10 years teaching oral surgery techniques using lasers.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. And it's really the only thing that has tempted me to walk away from writing. And I seriously considered going back to dental school in my early 40s.
Well, you know, that's a common choice that people have to make, you know, between dental school and writing.
Yeah.
That's pretty common.
So there were plenty of examples I had to follow when I made that choice.
That reminds me of the only consulting joke I ever knew is that, you know, if you ask a consultant what time it is, he'll take a look at your wristwatch and tell you.
I don't get it.
And that's why consultants have jobs.
That's exactly why they have jobs. Now, consulting is a really interesting niche because what you do is actually you just go in and you boil down the problem to elements that people can understand.
Well,
and you have that ability to...
I learned this from some of the best out there. Mm-hmm. The dirty little secret to consulting is that there's always somebody in the organization who knows what the problems are. Mm-hmm. They know what the solutions are, but nobody will listen to them.
Mm. Mm.
Because politically mm-hmm. or organizational chart or whatever mm-hmm. reason they want to use, they're unwilling to listen to this person. And maybe it's a combination of a couple of different people. And so as a consultant, you find these people.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's more than one, then you take an amalgamation of their ideas and present that to management. But it's surprising how many times that if you can find the one guy or the one gal in the organization that's a little long in the tooth, at least in terms of that job
experience, mm-hmm.
that experience,
right.
And they know what's going on and they know how to fix the problems, you find that person, download their head, refine it a little bit, and present it to the board.
Yeah.
They think
it's that same concept that, you know, I can tell my child something and he hears it completely differently from somebody else, or a teacher can say something and then he hears it completely differently.
It's funny you should say that. One of the books I've long wanted to write addresses that very thing, the list of things that kids won't learn from their parents but will listen to others.
Mm.
And I like to give working titles to the books that I write, and they don't always make it into print as the final title. Mm-hmm. But the working title for this one is, will somebody teach my kids the things that they won't learn from me?
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I'd read that book.
Well, I think there's a good market for that. So,
and the consulting gig, what a dovetail into ghostwriting, right? Because that's the same concept, is that you're, you know, the person who you're writing for knows all of the content, but then you're just polishing it, you know, repackaging it and presenting it, right?
Well, the skill that there's a couple of specific skills you pick up when it comes from in consulting that you transition quickly into ghostwriting. One is you learn to speak the language of a variety of industries.
Mm, mm-hmm.
You go in and you listen, and especially when you're jumping from company to company as you fulfill one contract after another, you get a chance to not only get industry lingo, but then you also get the specific language of a specific corporate culture within a particular industry. And you may go to another one of their competitors within the same industry, but they've got a corporate culture that has a different language.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning to speak the language of all these different mm-hmm. variations on the theme really starts to open your mind and open your ability to not only understand, but then to hear whatever somebody's saying to you and be able to translate it into the more common language so that people can come to you. And one of the things that I was known for, and I say, but I fully acknowledge that I developed a team of people. And as a team, we worked very well together.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we did as a team, one of the things we were known for is being able to take fairly complicated, difficult subject matter, things that were difficult to talk about for whatever mm-hmm. reason. Either they were too technical or they were too sacred or they were too emotional. For the pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take those things and put them into everyday language in a way that was acceptable and perfectly communicated what people mm-hmm. intended to say, but didn't know how to say it themselves.
Right. You know, one of my first writing partners, I did all the writing, and it was her story. And she's a LeBaron. She grew up in a polygamous community, but it's like hidden. And I remember being able to hear her just talk, and then I'd turn it into, you know, I'd turn it into the story, and I'd read it back to her, and she'd just be in tears.
Yeah.
And just say, "How did you do that? How did you take that out of me and turn it into that?" You know, so it's like I'm resonating with everything you're saying. Like, I used to do HR, and I got so much out of running an HR department that I use in writing. You know, there isn't anything that isn't useful on all my experience in hospitality.
If you're going to be a ghostwriter, that broad base of exposure to lots of different people with lots of different twists on the language that they're using. I mean, we all speak English in this country. We don't all, but you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. English is the common language, but English from down south and English from the northwest and northeast.
Entirely different.
And it's I'll give you one example. We were writing a book about something that happened in the Florida Panhandle, a life that was lived and some personal experiences there. And a lot of the people that highlighted in this story are still alive. And so there was some concern that they be outed for some of their misdoings. And so we decided to change the names, and we even changed the location of the story.
Right.
So nobody could trace it back, at least directly.
Right.
And so we decided to move it to a town up in Maine. But when you do that kind of thing, you have to be cognizant of colloquial phrases.
Exactly. Mm. The language doesn't always translate.
Here, for example, when we say, "Well, I'm going to go to grandma's house and she's about a 20-minute drive or 15 miles or whatever," you know, we talk in terms of time or distance. But up in the Northeast, they talk about how many towns. Oh, she's two towns away or a town away or she's, you know, four towns over.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to a Northeasterner, that connotes time and distance because a time is a unit of time and distance in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to go through the book and make all those little changes to make it authentic for the new venue and the new language within that venue.
And readers will call you out. You know, there's always somebody reading the book that's got that medical expertise, and they'll know if you're off. You know, that's something that's just so critical, because you can't let the reader be pulled out of the story.
Right.
You've got to keep them fused in the story. I remember when I moved to Texas, I lived in Texas. Did you know that? I lived in Texas for a short time.
I knew you lived in Texas.
Where?
And West Texas.
Where?
In Haskell. Haskell, Texas.
Okay.
Just north of Abilene. Yeah. A few towns over from Abilene.
Happiness is Texas in your rearview mirror.
Kind of. So I think
it's actually Lubbock in your rearview mirror.
Well, right? I invited people over for dinner. And they showed up at noon because dinner and supper is the evening meal. Dinner is the lunchtime meal.
There you go.
Yeah. It took me forever to figure out what fixin' meant. What are you talking about? But then, you know, after being there, I was only there for 3 months. I spoke that language.
Right.
You know.
So do you do that? Do you go immerse yourself in the culture then as part of the research? Or do you just find a local and ask them to be your beta reader?
When you're a ghostwriter, you rely heavily on the client to provide all that colloquial flavor of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Capturing a client's voice is absolutely essential, particularly those that are going to be on the speaking circuit, even if it's just to promote their book.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have them showing up with a spoken voice that has nothing to do with their written voice,
right,
and no connection.
Right.
That's one of the big, it's a laugher, all these multi-million dollar sports people who can't put a cogent sentence together in a post-game interview, but in their books they sound like PhDs.
Right.
Yeah. You've got to learn to capture the language. And we, as a team, we put together a pretty elaborate way of making sure that we did that. We only had one complaint of anybody in the 117 books that we've written as a team. And that complaint was a guy who was a multi-level success story. And part of his message is that anybody can do this. And he came back to us and said that, "You've captured my voice just fine. It really is me, but I want you to dumb it down so that people who don't have the education I have can read it and relate to it a little bit better. And so we tried to dumb it down and dumb it down and dumb it down. And finally he came to us one day and, you know, he paid the full fee and he was happy with what we'd done. But he said, it just occurs to me that I want it to sound a whole lot dumber. And if it gets any dumber, it
you'll have to start misspelling pictures words on every other page.
So the door's still open. If he ever wants to come back to us and, you know, let us finish that off for him, we will. But it's the only time we've ever had somebody not think that we captured his voice or did with his voice what he wanted us to do.
So in your career, you get to do what you want, which is right.
Yeah.
And that's incredible. But I want to know about how you let go of the vanity and the ego, because you can't talk about your clients without everybody on the podcast signing an NDA. You can't sign your name to the book. Nobody knows you wrote it. How does that come
and
into play?
And they don't even know it's ghostwritten, so they don't even know that there's some, you know, Superman in a cape somewhere. Know,
well, here's the other thing to consider if you're thinking about being a ghostwriter. Somebody comes to you and says, so I, you know, however you make the connection in the conversation that goes a little like this. So what have you written?
Yeah.
Well, none of your business.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, who are your clients? Well, I can't tell you.
Right.
And how much do you cost?
Yeah.
You know, 25, 30 grand, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, you want me to give you $25,000, $30,000, $35,000, but you're not going to show me any samples?
Which is actually ridiculously reasonable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's just unheard of.
Well, and we had good rationale for doing that as well, because there's all kinds of misconceptions out there about ghostwriting. And I, to in part answer your question that you asked without getting too far afield, but then also to address where we're going with this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways that you keep your ego in check is to distinguish right from the get-go the difference between being an author and being a writer.
Mm.
All of my clients are authors. Every one of their books came from their mind, their experience, it's their words, they authored the story.
Okay.
That doesn't mean they know how to write.
Sure.
And so I can either be an author or a writer or both. And there's very few people who can do both. I find it, there's a lot of people who have authored a story. They have something to say, but they have no ability to write it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really frustrated because it's not an efficient process for them.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people all the time, most of my clients are perfectly capable of writing their own books. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I'm building a house, I can do the plumbing as well. Now, since I've never plumbed a house, I'll have to be at Home Depot about every other day asking for little lessons on how to do this and how to do that. And I'll have to get a lot of consulting, and it'll take me forever to figure it out. And then I did it wrong, so I got to rip it out and do it again.
Yeah.
So it's not an efficient way of me publishing my story that I've authored. And so people who have something to say but don't have the time or the particular experience that allows them to efficiently write the story that they've authored, that's exactly why you need a ghostwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And so because I've been able to separate myself from the two.
There you go. Brain science.
You know, that's one way you do it.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Totally,
you know, I deal with that too with private clients that want to, you know, they want references. And it's like, well, I'm complete with this person. And part of my agreement with them is, you know, they don't necessarily want to acknowledge that they got writing coaching.
Right.
You know, because we're partnered for a year or more in this process, but I'm training them how to write and they're producing it, you know, but I don't.
Well, I find it particularly interesting in the political circles. In political circles, they have speechwriters and everybody knows it.
Right.
And it's okay.
Right.
Because the assumption is the speechwriter knows the principal well enough to write what they would normally have written themselves had they had the time, but they're busy people and they're doing other things.
Well, and they're approving it and
so,
you know,
on and so forth.
Right.
And so that's perfectly acceptable. But of the body of work that we've turned out, we've written for 3 senatorial candidates, 4 congressional candidates, 4 gubernatorial candidates, and not one of them wants to reveal that I've had anything to do with
their
writing. Because when you're known as a writer, as an author, when your picture and your name's on the book, there are so many assumptions made of your intellectual level, of the credibility of what your message is, that they don't want anything to deter from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, as a ghostwriter, that's one of the tough things that you've got to deal with. How do you convince somebody that you're worth whatever it is you're charging when you can't show them any samples or refer them to anybody that you've written for? Now, having said that, we've got a short list of people that have, after a period of time, have given us permission to give their names. Mm-hmm. But from amongst my clients, I have 4 New York Times best-selling books that have come from those clients. I can't say who they are. Mm-hmm. Now, what a marketing coup that would be if I could say, oh, yeah, I'm the guy who wrote.
Right.
Yeah.
But I can't.
Right.
So yeah. It's a little frustrating. This is a short answer to your
question.
You know,
it's just like being an FBI agent, right? You go to work every day, but you just can't talk about it, right?
That's right.
You're undercover.
Yeah, that's right.
I like that. I'm an undercover writer.
Bum, bum, bum.
I'm an undercover author.
There you go.
That's what it is.
So you talked about this book that you want to write. Have you written anything else under your name?
I have written a couple of things under my name, but nothing currently.
Okay.
I am writing something under my name right now. Mm-hmm. And when it's ready to go, I'll come back and tell you about it.
Excellent.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So yeah, that would be one of my questions would be, is there still that desire to publish under your name?
There is, but there's less of a drive for it. If nobody read anything I ever wrote, if I never made a dime from writing, if it ever gets to the point that I'm retired and nothing else to do and all my bills are paid, I'm going to write.
Yeah.
So I get great satisfaction from the process itself. And the fact that I've been able to make a good living doing it, that was the other piece of the puzzle. And the ego stuff and the celebrity and so on and so forth, I guess I've lived long enough now to realize that celebrity maybe isn't the best deal out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael.
Totally.
You should talk about your little triangle. Your triangle. That sounds awful. You gotta edit that out and just dive in.
Okay. Yeah, so one of the things that I teach is that there is this triangle. And if you picture a triangle, there's 3 legs to the triangle. One is profit, mm-hmm. one is personal, mm-hmm. and one is praise. Mm-hmm. And you can write for any, you can focus on any one of those reasons, and the other two may show up, but it's serendipitous, right?
Right.
So focusing on profit, you may not write the best literary masterpiece that you could turn out, right? But, you know, if you focus on praise, then you may not get the profit, right? So there's kind of that little, if you picture like a balance ball at the gym, right? Where you can really only focus on one of those at a time.
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples of books that I think have been very influential, but in very close quarters. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them have been bestsellers. Both of them have been Amazon top 10 reviews. But commercially speaking, they made money, not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. One was a book about stem cells. And again, I'm going to keep the titles and the clients' sure. names quiet mm-hmm. here. But one was about stem cells and why we don't have stem cell therapy in this country anywhere near the extent we should or that they have in other countries. And it has to do with the politics of big pharma. If you heal the problems, mm-hmm. then you don't need the drugs that address the symptoms right. or the pains and aches that mm-hmm. come along with those mm-hmm. symptoms. And so big pharma, and of course people think that's a ridiculous thing to say. How would they do that? Well,
no, it's a complete business. I have a client that's writing, which I can't talk much about this, right. but because it's not out yet, but all about this.
So. Sounds like a John Grisham novel.
Yeah. It's yes. scary. It's scary. It's like, no, it's like Fahrenheit 451. Yeah,
conspiracy theory stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of discussion. Now, one part of the discussion is about abortion. The pro-choice people have jumped on that as a justification for abortion because you need the tissue for stem cell research and so on. But the truth of it is the best stem cells for medical treatment don't come from fetal tissue, mm-hmm. they come mm-hmm. from afterbirth.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly.
And so,
But that's the propaganda that there is spun in order to keep exactly. big pharma in business.
Well, the reason the book was nonetheless influential is once it was written, it was delivered to every member of Congress. Mm-hmm. And they got a chance, or somebody on their staff got a chance to weigh in and to read so that when they did weigh in
on the subject
within mm-hmm. the legislative process, they had a clear view of what was really going on.
Oh, that's great.
And so we feel like we were being very influential. Another one a woman came to me and she said, yeah, she said, I want to write a book about the aftermath of suicide and what mm-hmm. happens when somebody makes that choice to all those that are left behind. She started to unfold her story. And Laurie Jane Graham is her name, and I do have permission to use that. But she came to me and she said, when I was a kid, my father turned a deer rifle on my mother and shot her 3 times in front of the kids.
Wow.
Wow.
And then when he realized what he'd done, he turned the gun on himself and killed himself in front of her. Later on, she was married, divorced, had a child in the process, and found out that the daughter was, at 14, was dating the town 20-year-old something drunk or drug dealer or whatever he was. Mm-hmm. And so she put an end to that. You may not see that boy anymore, and thought everything was, you know, handled. A year later, found out that the daughter had been sneaking around for a year and seeing this guy anyway, and that their relationship had developed to a very dangerous place. And one day from work, she came home and found a suicide pact note, and both of them had committed suicide in the backyard.
Oh, my goodness.
So this story is about her and how she dealt with somebody who, to put it in her words, the ultimate rejection is when the people you love the most decide they'd rather die than spend one more day in the world with you.
Hmm.
And how do you deal with that and the pain and so on? And anyway, long story short, and there's some other twists and turns in the books that are kind of surprising. But that book is being used in almost every suicide support group in the nation now.
Oh, that's great.
And so we think we've made a difference within that community.
Oh, definitely. You know, I'm a suicide survivor, and I wrote a book 20 years ago, something like that, about the near-death experience that I had as a result. And I will tell you, I get calls. I'm actually a reverend now, so that I am, and so are people who call me and reach out to me, are protected by the laws of confidentiality.
Good for you.
So they can, you know, and I'm safe talk trained.
Good for you.
So it's like all these years later, and there isn't a day that goes by that somebody doesn't reach out, you know, and either thank me or ask questions.
This goes back to your 3-point
triangle.
Triangle is, why are you writing? What are you doing? What good in the world are you doing? Listen, everybody's got a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I've had to do is determine, am I going to write every story? Because there's money in it. Mm-hmm. Should I just write any story that comes along? Years ago, the choice was made to only write the things that I felt brought a little more light into the world, a little more understanding, something that would be good, something I could be proud of, something I could point to one day, at least to my kids, who I make them sign NDAs as well. I'm kidding, I don't.
I make everybody sign NDAs.
But I want to be proud of the work that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And just within the close circle of people that are important to me. And even if I never develop any kind of celebrity, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we lead writers' courses. And that's how come I provide private coaching, is because I can't write all the books. I don't have enough time left. You know, the kind of books that I write take a lot of investigation, a lot of time. But I can empower thousands to write theirs. So I get you. Like, I know.
Good.
The audience can't see me doing this, but I'm doing that thing where I point at my eyes and then I point at your eyes. Yeah, you get it.
Which is rather intimidating when you're in the room.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like when she makes me call her Reverend Angie.
You're in trouble now, boy.
Yeah. When Reverend Angie shows up, you know you're in trouble. So, looking at your website, you've got very general clients and then what they wrote. And I mean, there's like some big time categories. I don't know what to call them. Like, you know, the clients, right? So what's been the biggest surprise? I mean, can you very generally, can you talk about any of that?
I don't know that surprise is the word I would attach to it, but it's been gratifying to see that some of the very biggest successes of life, at least of, you know, what we would consider successful. These are people that all followed the same principles of success. There's nothing new under the sun. When you decide that you want to make a difference in life, when you decide you want to be successful, when you decide you want to make money or have a family or recoup your health or whatever it is, there's a very short list of things that you always come back to, no matter what the pursuit is, which is why it's a principle, not a truth. Truth is something that kind of ebbs and flows, and it's relative and so on. You know, your truth
it's
and
about
my POV, truth, and so
point
on
of
and
view.
So forth. But principle has nothing to do with relativity. Principle is something that is true under any and all circumstances. And it's amazing to watch the people who have something to say, and especially if they're telling a story of success, even if it's only eventual success after many failures. It's been really gratifying to see that they all adhere to the same short list of principles. But as a ghostwriter, you could homogenize everything you write down so it's, every book sounds like the same thing. If you, I mean, you come to that realization that the principles are the same, but the stories and how people learn those things and how they implement those things and apply those things, that's what's unique about everybody's story. And
well, it's that same concept where, you know, I can't tell my child something, but his brother can.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
One of the things you have to do as a ghostwriter, and this is probably a good place to talk about this, is you have to learn to question correctly. You have to learn to interview. And that's something that I learned in business during many, many years. In fact, one person on our team was a retired attorney, and he knew how to depose people. And so we developed a hybrid way of extracting information from the client. And that's important because if you don't ask the right questions in the right orders in the right way, then you end up creating a story rather than revealing the story. And as a ghostwriter, your job is to reveal the story, not create a new one. You're trying to help them divulge and uncover and unwrap or unveil that which is already is. And quite frankly, anybody thinking about being a ghostwriter, that's really where your focus ought to be, is learning how to download somebody's head and really get it right, because that makes the writing so much easier.
I would say that bleeds over into every type of writing. If you're writing your own story, learning to interview yourself.
Yes.
If you're writing fiction.
Same thing.
Learning to interview those characters that you're creating and developing each one a single, their voice,
That's exactly right.
A fictional character is going to have its own voice versus the other fictional character. That interview process is so critical. And one of the things that I do in marketing and branding is I want to boil down what you want, what your message is. And so that starts out in a whole interview process the same way, I think. So
I'll give you a little family example of what I'm talking about. I have a niece that came home from school one day, and she was kind of teary and said to her mom, I'm blind, and you know, they told me to tell you to take me to the eye doctor. And she said, well, okay. And so like a good mom, she bundled it up and took her down for an eye exam. And in the eye exam, it turns out she couldn't read the eye chart there either. And that was the problem at school. She couldn't read the eye chart, any part of it. And my sister's just shaking her head thinking, boy, how has she been coping with eyesight that bad? I mean, I had no idea. And she's feeling guilt as a mother and everything.
Sure.
So they ended up making an appointment, went to a specialist. And sure enough, they took her in and they did the eye chart thing just to start. And she completely failed it. And at that point, my sister just said, there's something wrong here. She said, let me come back and do the test again. But I'm gonna watch and see what's going on. So they said, cover your left eye and read the top line. And she covered her left eye and looked up and then turned to her mother and said, I don't know those words.
Oh, she was trying to read.
She was asked to read as if those were words.
Yeah, those don't.
She couldn't make any sense of that collection of letters and words that they made.
Oh, man.
And so you have to learn to make yourself very clear as you ask questions, and then you have to listen to what's being said and in turn figure out how to make that very clear to the audience. So it's a really important part of being a ghostwriter is you're a translator.
Yeah.
You have to be able to download their heads, but you have to download the right stuff. You can't create this story by the way you ask the questions or even the order you ask the questions. You have to ask the right questions in the right order and in the right way, or you don't get a good download.
So how much time do you spend actually interviewing for one book?
Well, this is the part. I'll answer that, but I've got to lay a foundation for it first.
Okay.
So that you know, my clients are not people who want to mess around with some cathartic effort to come to a better understanding of who they are and
right.
where they are and what they think about this or that or something else. There's certainly a place for that. And people who come to writing conferences and that kind of thing, a lot of them are, they're trying to figure out a long list of things in their own life, and writing is a really good way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And being at a writing conference so that they learn the skill that helps them clarify and to organize their thoughts, I think that's marvelous. And I would recommend that everybody come to a writing conference and learn as much as you can about communicating in writing, because it requires you to organize and crystallize and to question your thoughts and to make your case,
mm-hmm.
if for no one else, to yourself. And so I think writing, I don't care what you major in college, your minor should be writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that ability to communicate, and especially in the written word.
It's getting lost.
Is invaluable.
Yeah, it really is, and it's important to do that. But my clients aren't the people who fit into that category.
Right. They want somebody else to come in and do it for them.
Well, but my clients are the ones that have, you know, typically, and this is where a lot of our successes come from in terms of our marketing, you know, people think, well, maybe I need a ghostwriter. And so they go online and they look. And there's four or five, you know, decent options out there, you know, for ghostwriting services. And then they don't do anything, but they come back 6 months later or a year later and they check again and there's four or five and we're still there and others have dropped away and have gone away. And then a few more months or even years go by and they check again. It turns out you're the only person that is there every time they look, because ghostwriters come and go so fast.
Okay.
So when they finally get enough of waiting around, and it's just finally it's time to tell the damn story, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they've just had enough of waiting. They've just had enough of dawdling along and so on and so forth. Those are the people we get. The ones that it's time to write the story. I want it done. I want it done now.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, how long does it take us? It varies from client to client, depending on what the book is. If they come to me, for example, with a personal story or maybe a company history but they're the founder of a company, so it's their story / company history, or if it's a political book or it's a business philosophy book that's pushing towards one particular theory or another and making the case. These books normally fall within a range of somewhere between 220 and 280 pages worth of content,
right, okay,
to really make it marketable.
Mm-hmm.
I can download somebody's head in typically 2 to 3 days for a book that ends up being somewhere between 220 and 280 pages. Again, we've really got the interview thing down. And so I sit down with somebody and we start off and we ask questions and we work right through the day. And I always tell people when they ask that question up front, how long is this going to take? And I always say, well, the equivalent of 2 days or the equivalent of 3 days. And they say, well, why not just 2 or 3 days? Because I don't know how much strength you have to hang in there.
Okay.
It's going to be really intense.
And
if you can hang in there with me, then we can get this done in 2 or 3 days.
Well, and then how long does it take you to write the book, to get the book cranked out typically?
I typically have a first draft ready for their review in about 90 days.
Okay.
And then the process is they go through it, make whatever additions, deletions, corrections, edits, changes, whatever they want. They give it back to us and we'll do a rewrite. Then they get it back again. And they go over it again. And typically it goes back and forth 4 or 5 times in a 3 or 4 mm-hmm. week period, if they're on the clock and they have urgency. We have had books that have manuscripts that have gone back and forth every 10 days for 14 months.
Mm.
And we've done that. We've in fact, the only time we told that client, no, we're not doing another rewrite, is when he called and literally said the word, stop the presses. Because it was printing as we spoke.
Oh, wow.
And said, I want to change the position of one comma. I think it reads better if we change.
Oh, that's me.
And that's the first time we said no.
That is me.
So we try to learn that now. And we learned our lesson with that. Mm. Of the many lessons learned about how to be careful with clients, one of the lessons we learned is that we'll do as many edits, as many back and forths, as many rewrites as necessary. Once they see the completed first draft, from that point forward, you can go back and forth as many times as possible, but typically only for about 90 days.
Yeah.
And if it goes beyond that, then we sit down and talk about additional fees.
Yeah. I used to pull books off the shelf at Barnes & Noble and fix typos.
Yeah.
Her own books. Yeah.
Yeah. My own books. And then I'd sign them and I'd put it back. But yeah, there's five typos in this one, in the first edition. And I just fixed the one typo that changed context.
Right.
The rest of them I ignored.
That's funny. Yeah.
No, so I can get that. I can get that on both sides, though, you know.
I should also mention about fees and how you collect fees and what you demand. First of all, there's a mean way to say it and a nice way to say it. Mm-hmm. The mean way is saying it, no serious writer writes on spec. But that
kind
of a mean way to say it.
Yeah.
Because most writers don't know that. And it's just simply not knowing that allows them to think that, oh, I'll write this and we'll share the profits and everything. Mm-hmm. But serious writers, people who do it for a business, they don't write on spec ever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what you think and how well it'll be accepted, how much of a market there is for it. You do not write on spec. There's too many things that have nothing to do with you or even your client and you don't control it. Mm-hmm. That means the book will never come out, which means you just work for free, turn out a masterpiece, a bestseller possibly, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but because it got caught up in a divorce or a lawsuit or the client died and now the family, it's stuck in probate along with all the other assets of a left behind life. There's too many things that keep the book from ever being sold. And you collecting, and so you never write on spec, ever.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's a tough lesson to learn because, you know, there's always that, you know, hope and dreams and everything like that, that if you've got some writing talent, but you don't have a name out there, then how do you get started? You know, what do you...
Well, but it's the same for clients. If a client really has something to say... And their pitch to you is that they want you to be as committed or more committed than they are to their project. They're not ready to tell their story. Mm-hmm. If they're as committed to their story as they want you to be, they'll pony up and give you some money.
Right.
If they don't come up with the money, then their story's not finished. Because part of the story is how mm-hmm. did I tell my story? Mm-hmm. How did I do whatever it took, you know, and beg, borrow?
Well, something that I've discovered is that human beings relate to two things, like they're finite, time and money. Mm-hmm. And their skin isn't in the game.
Right.
If there's not an investment, you know. So it doesn't serve them, anyway, the client, to do it for them on spec because it's not going to be the same product. Because when their skin is in the game, then they are different about the process too.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, going back to the time frames that we've already discussed, if I spend 2 days with you and you don't have to do any research because you're only there telling me about something you've already lived or something you already think or an opinion you already have, then you basically sit down and have 2 or 3 days worth of conversation and then you're back to your normal mm-hmm, life. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to spend the next 90 days mm-hmm. toiling and laboring and writing and rewriting. And, you know, when I hand somebody a completed first draft, it's neither complete nor the first draft. It's just the first one they're seeing. Mm-hmm. I probably have done four or five complete rewrites before they see the first one.
Right.
And it's not complete in that I fully expect them to come back and edit and give me changes and corrections and so on and so forth. But the working name for it is we give them a completed first draft. But I'm 90 days into it and they're two.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Unless there's money in it as well, they don't care anywhere near as much about it as I do. Yeah. I'm at least 45 times more mm-hmm. invested than they are in mm-hmm. that process.
Mm-hmm. So have you ever nailed it on the first draft where you presented it to them and they just said, oh, this is beautiful?
No.
I hope you were going to say no. Because
yeah, I was over here cringing.
No.
I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, no. You know, even as seasoned a writer as you are and as nailed down as you've got the process, one of the things that we teach is that the magic happens in the rewrites. And you don't nail it on the first time ever. There's no way.
I train people to get their first draft out, especially just get it out. If it's fiction in particular.
Right.
You know, because... Nonfiction, you can sell, you do sell it on, you do land your agent and sign the publishing contract on the proposal. Mm-hmm. And so I have my nonfiction clients are writing the proposal first, and that's where they learn to write, is in that short form. Because if you can get it to short form and have it just, you know, be stellar, they can write the long version.
I'll tell you a personal story of something that taught me this. Back in the day, I was assigned to live for a couple of years in France. Mm-hmm. And
rough gig.
Yeah. but I was required to speak French. And I was this kid that grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and I didn't speak Spanish.
I grew up in Tucson.
Oh, did you really?
I did.
Oh, well, we'll have to talk about
that. I know.
What, did you go to high school?
I don't know. I left when I was 7. I moved to Hanes, Vegas. But okay. I went to Dietz Vegas. Elementary.
Is that on the west side?
You went to Dietz?
And I lived on Random Ridge Drive. Oh. I can tell you that.
All I can tell you is that Fickett Junior High always beat Dietz Junior High.
Oh, really?
All right. Back it up. Hang on. Don't make me pull this car over, you two.
You had a better name than we did. I'll admit that. So. But anyway, I didn't know anything about French, but I was sent to a souped up cram course. It was a 2-month a total immersion French course, and I was supposed to learn about 3 years worth of college French in 8 weeks. 6 weeks into the experience, my three instructors pulled me aside and just shook their heads and said, "You're the worst student we've ever had." We've actually contacted headquarters and asked them to reassign you to someplace English speaking because you can't find your way to a drinking fountain in French. And then two of them walked away. And it's a pretty discouraging moment. But the third one put his arm around my shoulders and said, "Hey, buck up here, bud." And then he said this. He said, "Becoming fluent in French is the process of making and correcting 1,000 mistakes. If you could physically do that in 3 days, then on the fourth day you would be fluent. But if you stretch it out and you let everybody else do the talking, or you're afraid to make the mistakes because you're going to be embarrassed, or you make the mistakes but you're too lazy to go back and correct them, and you stretch this process out of making and correcting 1,000 mistakes for 2 years, then in 2 years and 1 day, you'll be fluent, but that's the day you're on the plane coming home."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's up to you.
Yeah.
I took him very literally at that, and I started making and correcting mistakes as fast as I possibly could. I would actually hand 3x5 cards to people I was speaking with once I got in country, and I'd give them a pen and a card and say, "Hey, I'm new to your language, so as I'm speaking, if I make a mistake, write it down, and I'll look it up later and fix it."
Oh, that's great.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And what it did is it made them really listen close to what I was trying to say, which was good for them, but on the same time, it really did give me this great list of things to work on later on in my personal grammar study. And so long story short, by the time I was there for 6 months, I spoke as well as any of the other foreign nationals. By the time I'd been there 9 months was the first time somebody mistook me as a French native. By the time I'd been there a year, unless I told them, they didn't know I was American. Mm-hmm. Now, I always sounded a little different from their particular corner of France.
Right.
So if I was in the south of France, they thought I was from Lyon. Or if I was in Lyon, they thought, well, maybe he's from Switzerland, but he's French-speaking Switzerland. Or if I was in Vichy in the center, then maybe, you know, he sounds a little like he's from the south. So they knew it was a little something different, but they always considered it native. And when I got home and started college, the very school that I essentially flunked out of, the immersion class, they sought me out and said, "Hey, we hear your French is pretty good. Will you teach for us?" So that's what I did as a part-time
there
child.
There you go.
I would teach French. Now, the disclaimer, 40 years later, I don't speak French that well anymore. You know, a lot of it's gone by the board, and so I'm not making any proficiency claims at this point. But making and correcting 1,000 mistakes.
That's
yes.
Great
is
analogy.
Exactly.
Used in
that's
everything
fabulous.
I've done in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. You can become fluent in anything if you're willing to make and correct the mistakes.
This is true. I lived in Japan for 3 years, and I was pretty good, but I would just wander off with my little kids off to a part of the island where they hardly saw Americans, and we'd just go and we'd play. But what happened is my boy, he was 5, he was in an immersion program, and I came to a point where I could speak fairly good, but I still couldn't go through a McDonald's drive-thru and order a Big Mac and have them understand me. So my son would hang out the window and he would say it. And he had no accent. Like, he sounded Japanese, this little blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid, right? So I stopped learning the language because I had, yep, you know, my kid along. Yeah. Yeah, he could translate for me, which is very interesting. Yeah. But now I confuse my Japanese with my Spanish. I have zero skills. I once told a woman her little girl was scary because kawaii is cute and kawaii is scary, or it's the other way around. No, kawaii. And see, you can, like, I don't even sound Japanese. I did when I lived in Japan. I promise. I swear. Anyway. Okay.
Point taken. Good job. Cool story, bro. Well, John, it has been an absolute pleasure. Any parting words of advice to our budding authors out there?
Short list of things, maybe.
Yeah. But
writers write. So whatever else you're doing in life, you got to take the time to write. And if you don't, maybe you're not a writer.
Mm.
And that's okay, too. Mm-hmm. But if you're a writer, then writers write. Make and correct 1,000 mistakes. You have to be willing to do that.
I love that.
Check your ego at the door. It doesn't serve anybody's purposes to be all uppity about whose name and picture is on what book and so on and so forth. Particularly if you're going to be a ghostwriter, make sure that you really believe in what you're doing. Make sure that the things that are most important to you, that you make the connection between those things and what you do every day. One of the things that makes, no matter how much time and effort or energy I don't have, I find a little anyway to write every day. Why? Because my writing is what allows me to make a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very gratified, I guess is the word. I could choose to write my own story. I could choose to say what I think. I could choose to spend all my time, energy, and skills, you know, putting out my opinions. I just think it's more important to use whatever abilities I have, whether they're God-given or have been developed over the years because of the opportunities I've had. I just as soon use my skills to help a lot of other people tell their stories. But I'm selective as to who I loan those skills to. That way, if I think I have something worth saying, I say it. I say it under my own name with my own picture on the back of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody else has something to say of worth, then I help them too. And
that's
I don't care
great.
If it is their picture name on the book. Mm-hmm. I'm doing something good in the world. So
that's awesome.
Make the connection between what you do every day as a writer and what's most important to you. And you'll find the time and place and energy and money and focus and motivation to be a writer.
Well, and I think it's very common out there for our audience when people learn that you're a writer, one of the most often asked questions is, will you help me write my book? If you find yourself in that situation and you're not interested in writing their story, you can find John at mybookcoach.net.
Mm-hmm.
And is there any other way to get in touch with you? Is that the best way?
That's usually the best way. You can go on there and leave me a message or even give me a call. All the contact information is there. I don't charge anything for initial conversations or even for initial interviews. I'll tell you what I do with people is when they call in, they think they've got something. I always send them a non-disclosure agreement,
mm-hmm.
promising not to use anything they share with me without their permission.
Mm-hmm.
Step one. Step two, I'm going to interview them for 20, 30 minutes by phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll decide whether or not I think that we're a good
match. Yeah.
And if it is a good match, then I'll call them back and I'll make proposals. We'll talk details. They'll know everything up front that they need to know to make a decision about moving forward. If I don't think it's a good match, I'll call them back anyway and I'll tell them so. And then I'll try to help them find somebody who I think would be a better match for them. So it doesn't hurt to call me and it doesn't cost anything to call me and go through the preliminaries. You're either going to end up with a solid proposal and be able to make a decision for me, or I'm going to help you find somebody else that can help you better than I can.
Well, John, you are certainly a blessing to the writing community.
Yeah, just
and certainly
advice.
A blessing to
thank
us
you.
As a guest on this
podcast.
Well,
thank you. It's been a pleasure being here.
Yeah, we look forward to bringing you back as a guest when you've got your own book out.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that myself.
Excellent.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe so that you get each new episode as it comes out. You can find all of our episodes and show notes at calliopepodcast.com. Don't forget to shoot some stars our way if you like the show.